Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Hey there, AgRack listeners. I am excited to announce that I will be speaking at the Aspen Anesthesia Seminar. That's from February 1st to 8th, 2025, at the Viceroy Snowmass Resort in Snowmass, Colorado, that's put on by Holiday Seminars. This is a fantastic organization that puts on CME seminars in beautiful locations, and they do a really, really great job of having amazing speakers and putting on a great show for everyone who's going to come. So I highly encourage you, if you're looking for a place to go, do some skiing and get great CME, check it out. You can go to holidayseminars.com. You can register there as well as learn more information about it. And if you choose to come, you'll have me there as well as some other amazing speakers throughout the course of the week. I hope to see some of you there. Hello, and welcome back to AgRack. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have with me two amazing guests today on a topic I've wanted to cover for years, and certainly this, being at Johns Hopkins, is a perfect place to do it, and I'm really excited to introduce these two people who are going to talk about it with me. The topic is psychedelics, specifically for things like pain and depression, but we'll cover some general topics on psychedelics as well. I have with me first Rebecca Ehrenkrantz, who is has a background in epidemiology and focuses on well-being in older adult populations. And she's currently a postdoc in David Yaden's lab working on psychedelics for chronic pain.
And I also have Patrick Finan.
Patrick is the Harold Karen Professor in the Department of Anesthesiology at the University of Virginia School of Medicine, formerly here at Johns Hopkins, and also doing amazing work in this area. So I want to welcome you both to the show. I'm really excited to have you here.
And thank you so much.
Thanks. Right. So let's start with some background about the two of you. And Rebecca, maybe we'll start with you. Tell me a little bit about kind of what you do. I know you're a postdoc. Some people listening may not know exactly what that means. So tell us what is a postdoc? And then, you know, kind of what was your path to get to do to be where you are doing the research you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a PhD in epidemiology from University of Pittsburgh, and my focus there was really on neural correlates of well-being in older adults. And as a postdoc, it's basically a postgraduate training program, really very heavily research focused, where I've been able to kind of transition my focus to shift towards interventions, in this case, psychedelics, for conditions that I care about and populations that I'm interested in. So it involves being able to transition from the population level to looking at these kind of clinical, smaller clinical trials, and understanding then how that might eventually relate to the population level and generalizability.
Great. And Patrick, how about you? Tell us a little bit about how you got where you are and what you do.
Sure. Yeah. So I am a clinical psychologist with a sort of specialty training in pain psychology. And I have been running a research lab for a number of years now, looking at various mechanisms and treatment opportunities for patients with chronic pain to try to understand what contributes to individual differences in the experience of pain. Our lab focuses on a number of issues that are really relevant to people with chronic pain, like the intersection of pain and emotions, and particularly pain and positive emotionality. And we also do a lot of work with sleep and pain. And it's kind of through these avenues, these kind of mechanistic avenues, that I became interested in the potential for psychedelics for chronic pain. And that kind of started when I was working with Roland Griffiths and Fred Barrett and others on their major depressive disorder trial a number of years ago, and started to really see by being, an outcomes assessor on that trial, a blinded outcomes assessor, where I had no idea what condition people were in when they were reporting their depressive symptoms to me, started to really see massive changes take place over the course of that trial. People reporting just reductions in depressive symptoms that I hadn't seen in many other studies that I had been involved in over my career, kind of really piqued my interest about the possibility of those types of effects extending to patients with chronic pain, and started talking to Roland Griffiths, who's now deceased, but really was a pivotal part of, in fact, wrote the grant with me that we now have to study psilocybin in patients with chronic low back pain and comorbid depression. And so that's where we are now, running that study now with David Yaden as the co-PI and Rebecca and many others in the center involved.
Fabulous. Well, this is really exciting stuff. So let's start with the very basics. When we say psychedelics, what are we talking about? What does that include? Give us a little bit of a background, Rebecca. What do we need to know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, classic psychedelics, which is what our focus is going to be on, are essentially substances whose mechanism of action is mediated by serotonin 5-HT2A receptors. So they're serotonergic substances, and they tend to modulate neural circuits that are involved in mood and in affective disorders. So some of the classic psychedelic substances that people talk about include things like psilocybin, which is going to be what's currently being used in our psychedelic trial of chronic low back pain and depression, as well as substances such as LSD or mescaline. And so some of these substances have very well-known kind of acute subjective effects. So that can include things like differences in visual perception, altered states of consciousness. People can often report things like an increased sense of connectedness or unity or love, and all of these different types of positive effects. Some of the positive effects have been shown to persist as well, including up to maybe even a year after taking the psychedelic substance. I do also want to mention, of course, that psychedelics are not all entirely positive. Adverse events do occur. Those adverse events can include, really challenging emotional experiences, ego dissolution, and things like that people find really, really challenging to experience. So those things do occur, and we just need to keep that in mind when we kind of consider the landscape of psychedelics and their potential to be used in treating various conditions. But in more recent years, say the last two or so decades, psychedelics have been trialed in a few different mental health conditions, including depression, treatment-resistant depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, substance use disorder, such as tobacco use, and broadly have shown a lot of promise in treating these varied conditions. So while, of course, more research needs to be done, larger studies, more generalizable study populations, a lot of good work has been done already.
Yeah, fabulous. Now, again, very basic question, but when people started thinking, oh, maybe these medications or substances could be used for depression and pain, was it because, as you described, they can produce really feelings of joy, feelings of well-being that sort of naturally suggest they might counteract something like depression? Or was it because we have this whole class of drugs that are also serotonergic, right? The SSRIs that are used for depression. And now you're saying, and again, this shows my ignorance here, that I'm sure it's not the same receptors or acting in the same way, but was that a natural, well, these are also serotonergic, maybe we should try them, or neither, or both? What do we know about that?
Well, one thing that I think we've been particularly interested in is these kind of acute and persisting positive effects of psychedelics, and basically the role that psychedelics may have to play in terms of affect. And while Patrick can certainly speak to this more so than I can, really it could be used in affective pain management, especially in this chronic low back pain situation, and really helping people not just who are experiencing pain, but, not just in terms of tamping down on the pain, but how people manage it, how people perceive it, how people react to it, all of those sorts of things. So we think that there's definitely some potential there as well.
Patrick,
if I could add on to that, I think, you know, yes, we've known for quite a while that serotonergic drugs are have sort of varying degrees of efficacy for treating mood symptoms and pain. But the magnitude of those effects is variable, and often, you know, when we look across trials, generally modest. And for some people, it doesn't work. And there's a lot of kind of interest and effort to try to understand why certain drugs or even non-pharmacological therapies work for some patients and why they don't work for others. When it comes to the broad class of psychedelics, and if we sort of drill down specifically with psilocybin, which is a 5-HT2A agonist, yes, I think there is certainly an interest, like, oh, this is a receptor system that we understand that's involved. But the magnitude of effects that have started to come out of trials over the last decade, I think, is what has been perhaps so surprising broadly to the field, and what has been so interesting to try to replicate with more rigorous research designs. And there's a lot of questions about the rigor involved in some of these early studies, and whether larger and more rigorous trials will maintain the same magnitude of effects. But the striking piece, I would say, the take home is that both the magnitude of effects that we've seen and the fact that those effects have largely been observed through the administration of just one dose or sometimes two doses of psilocybin. And so this creates, if it turns out to be a, to hold up to more rigorous trials, maintain a safety profile that we think it has, a possibility of a treatment that has relatively limited drug exposure with a sort of maximized duration of effect.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so fascinating, right? There's nothing else that I know like that, where a single dose or a couple of doses has that kind of potentially permanent or very long-lasting effect. Most drugs that have long-lasting effect, we think you have to take them on an ongoing basis. Antihypertensives, for example, or traditional antidepressants. Is the thought, maybe we don't know this, but is the thought that there is some kind of structural change or happening in the brain with a relatively small number of doses that then has a long-lasting effect, or do we not know that yet?
There's certainly some data, particularly neuroimaging data, that suggests that there are neuroplastic changes that occur that are long lasting. But again, the caveat, and we'll probably repeat this caveat throughout today, which is, you know, these are largely from smaller studies, and there's questions about the degree of control of those studies. You hear lots of debates in the psychedelic field about the degree to which expectancy is or is not involved in these changes, both the subjectively reported changes and the neuroplastic changes that we're seeing, which expectancy can impact. And I think it's an open debate, the extent to which that has been and will be involved in psychedelic effects. So, you know, yes, changes are happening at the level of biology and at the level of self-report that appear to extend, that certainly extend far beyond the time that the drug is in the system, right?
Yeah. And when you say expectancy, Patrick, is that the effect that, is that almost like a placebo effect, like what someone expects to happen, or is that a different?
Yeah, that's right. It's in the class of placebo effects, right? That where, you know, when you go into a study, and every clinical trial deals with this, patients have an expectancy for a benefit, either positive or negative, and people are going to vary in the degree of expectancy that they have. And in a number of these, and I will just characterize where we are now as the early stages, right? So in a number of these early psilocybin trials, particularly for people with major depressive disorder, for example, who have failed previous treatments. These are folks who often are coming into the trial where their expectancy for anything else to work is very low, because they've been through it and they're not better. And yet they are open to the possibility of this treatment working and might become increasingly, have an increased expectation as they proceed in the trial, as they go through the preparation to really kind of want this effect to happen. And that's not a bad thing. But what we need to do and what we are doing and many others are doing is trying to really disentangle those types of effects from the agonist effects of the drug and trying to understand where does integration of those two effects optimally lie, right? Because both of them are going to be on board, and we really should know how powerful one versus the other is and maybe what the synergistic effects of the two combined could be.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, is it possible to blind a trial of psychedelics? I mean, you can't really tell someone that if they know they're going to have a mind-altering experience, then if they don't have it, they kind of know they got the placebo, right?
Yeah. So there are ways to try to deal with that blind. It is highly imperfect and very different than what you commonly are used to with, other depression drugs where you're using them repeatedly over time and they don't have especially psychoactive effects that are perceptible. And so, yes, you can attempt to blind with other psychoactive agents, which are going to create increased heart rate with brief periods of anxiety that might be construed as a potential psilocybin or other psychedelic effect. So you can do that, but you have to understand exactly what you said, that the kind of the difference between a full moderate to high dose of something like psilocybin and any other kind of psychoactive control condition that we have currently seen it's a pretty wide gulf at the moment.
Okay. Interesting. Now, psilocybin, is that found in mushrooms? Is that how people would think of it? Is that the, active ingredient in what people think of in terms of mushrooms you would take to have a mind-altering experience?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
And so when we use it in a study, is it kind of made synthetically or is it purified from wild type?
It's made synthetically.
It's made synthetically. Okay, so same chemical, but not found in the wild. All right.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So that's kind of, and tell me if I'm getting this right, but where we are with the current evidence is that there's not a lot of big trials and that there are some things that make these trials difficult, such as the blinding. It's possible, like you mentioned a couple options, Patrick, but I'm guessing that because the small studies that are out there have, as you said, produced quite impressive effects, that what we want to know is, in a bigger trial, are we going to see these replicated?
Yeah. Absolutely. And for the record, we do expect to see effect sizes probably decrease over time as we run these larger trials, as we get different populations enrolled in these trials. We do expect to see some of these effect sizes decrease, which isn't to say that they're not there, but some of the really large effect sizes might not reproduce to the same extent.
Okay. And when we say the kind of data that already is out there, are we talking about are there small studies with just a few pages? Like, what are we talking about? What is the data include so far?
Well, one of the larger trials, just to give you a sense of the scope of what's a large trial, has 220 patients in it. That was a study on depression, and that was, I think, to the best of my awareness, the largest psychedelic clinical trial to date, for classic psychedelics at least.
And what did it show?
It showed good persisting effects of psychedelics in the treatment of depression. That study also tried to manage some of these blinding effects by using different doses of psilocybin. So they had a low dose around 1 milligram, and then they had a moderate dose, and then they had a higher dose at 20, 25 odd milligrams. So that's okay. One of the different ways in which people are trying to manage these kind of blinding expectations is by using different doses.
And does there appear to be a dose-dependent effect, more effective with a higher dose or not?
It does. For subjective effects, it does appear to be a dose-dependent effect.
Okay. So what is the next step? Are we now moving into a larger trial? You mentioned, Patrick, that you and both of you as well as your colleagues are involved in a bigger trial. I think that's looking at chronic low back pain and depression. So you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, Rebecca was referring to a trial in major depressive disorder. There are not currently published trials in chronic pain. There are several ongoing trials, and ours is one of them. And there are, you know, a number of others. There are some published data in patients with migraine and other headaches. So I shouldn't say there aren't published trials in chronic pain. There are published data in migraine and other headaches, and there are published case reports, in, for example, like phantom limb pain. And then you can go back to the 60s, and there are some really kind of interesting LSD studies that were published in chronic pain, various types of chronic pain patients back then. Currently, what we're largely working with is a waiting game for a number of ongoing clinical trials that are currently being run in different chronic pain populations. I believe, you know, at least those that are being conducted at academic centers that I'm aware of are all relatively smaller studies. I suspect, but this is pure speculation, that there are some larger studies in the works in industry in chronic pain, because this is now becoming a really an area that the field is really interested in pursuing. Our trial is, we hope, making advances in terms of rigor, but I can't say that it's making advances in terms of size. So it is also another small clinical trial. It's funded by the NIH. And so that, I think, is a good bellwether of where we are now, that the NIH is now interested and actively funding clinical trials testing various psychedelics as therapeutics for various indications. And ours is specifically targeting patients with chronic low back pain and comorbid depression. We're ultimately going to end up with a sample of 20 or 40 participants, 20 in each condition. And we do have a control condition in which we're comparing the psilocybin condition to. Yeah. So how did we arrive at this particular target? We led with the data that we had already gathered, right? And so our data, the largest and sort of most, the most rigorous and perhaps most impactful study in recent years to come out of center was the trial in patients with major depressive disorder. And so we knew that, we were getting really large effect sizes on depression outcomes. The next logical step seemed to be, all right, let's stick with people who have depression, but let's also add chronic pain to the mix, because we know that chronic pain and depression are so highly comorbid bidirectionally related. And so the idea here was that we would target a population with chronic pain who appear to have particularly high rates of depression. And chronic low back pain is both a highly common chronic pain disorder and one that is associated with very high rates of comorbid depression and disability of all sorts. And so that was the kind of idea there is we're going to sort of follow the data we have. We're going to take it in a new population that's not so new that there's going to be kind of a bunch of blind alleys. You know, we're still working with patients who have depression, but they also have pain, and we're kind of approaching the treatment from that angle, sort of recognizing and understanding their pain, listening to them about their experiences with pain, and allowing them to sort of work through the treatment with that to the extent that they are interested, sort of front and center, like this is a treatment for their pain.
Great. So there's, when you say there's 20 patients in each arm or each condition, what do you mean? 20 with depression, 20 with back pain, or no, there, you mean 20 getting depression. A certain,
yeah. So we have, you know, we have a psilocybin condition, and then we have a control condition where they receive a blinded control, drug. And so, and they're informed about that. We go through an informed consent process, and we tell them that they have a 50-50 chance of getting one versus the other. But the sort of therapeutic structure around that is the same either way. We prepare them because we're blinded too. So we don't know, you know, and so in order to safely and effectively do this, we go through the full process of preparing them for an active psilocybin dose, and then working with them after the dosing session in what we call integration, where the focus is on kind of working through any insights that may have been gained, challenging experiences, you know, positive experiences, and how the patient intends on applying those experiences into their everyday life going forward. And so we're doing all of that in both conditions, essentially the same. It's just that the it's either going to be active psilocybin or a control drug.
Okay. And that is my understanding, is that you do need the kind of help of a therapist or guide, right? Like you don't just go home and take a pill and have this, you know, result, right? You need to kind of, just as you said, to kind of work through the experience with someone trained to do that. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's very standard in all of these different psychedelic clinical trials, is to have the preparatory sessions, the dosing sessions being supported by, we call them guides, but again, these practitioners who have been working with the participant, as well as to do follow-up integration sessions. So participants are really provided with support at every step of the way.
Great. It did occur to me, could you tell participants before they get their treatment that, and or has this ever been done, that you say to them, we actually are giving you a dose of this drug that is low enough that we don't expect you to have any noticeable change in your sensorium, knowing that won't be true for half of them. But if they go into it expecting not to, and they don't, then they wouldn't necessarily think they were in the control arm. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, I mean, that would be like a nocebo almost, or not quite nocebo, because you're not inducing negative expectations, but right. You're, you know, an explicit blunting of the placebo effect through an expectation manipulation. That would be interesting. There are folks who are really interested in this idea of manipulating expectations for therapeutic benefit. We're not doing that, but I think, you know, it'd certainly be many of us talk about these issues in the psychedelic space with the understanding that, like, wouldn't it be cool to do that? It's so hard to pull off these studies now that, and I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't seen some of those, like, really creative, kind of out there, interesting concepts be tested, because, you know, the regulatory work that goes into getting any of these studies off the ground is so substantial that, you know, they all tend to be for clinical indications with, you know, more bread and butter outcomes and more standard ish clinical trial design. So I think that's why we haven't seen a lot of that yet. I do think over time we'll start to see more of those really kind of interesting manipulations take place.
Yeah, interesting. So with this study, are participants who get the psilocybin all getting the same dose, or are there different doses?
Everyone gets the same dose in this study.
And is that a dose that was arrived at because it was effective in prior studies?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And where is it on the, you said there were prior studies that kind of gave a small, a medium, a large. Is it what's generally considered a kind of middle of the road dose? Is it on the high end? Is it on the low end?
I mean, this would be considered a dose from which we would expect to see subjective effects in participants who receive this dose.
Okay. And then
so it's a larger dose.
It's a larger dose. And the folks getting the placebo are getting just a sugar pill. I mean, there's nothing psychoactive about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, folks, I am so excited to announce that at this year's American Society of Anesthesiology annual meeting in Philadelphia, we will have another live ACRAC podcast. It will be Saturday, October 19th from 2:15 to 3:30 p.m. at Center Stage, and I will be interviewing Dr. Valerie Arcouche, who is the Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services. She's in charge of the entire state of Pennsylvania's public health service, and we're going to hear about her career in public service, how she transitioned from being a clinical anesthesiologist to this career in public service, and what leadership on a statewide level looks like. I'm thrilled to be interviewing her, and I hope you'll join us live, where you'll have a chance to ask her some questions as well. See you there.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Aloe or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
All right, and we're back. And I was asking whether there is an active placebo or whether it's just a sugar pill.
Well, this is an active placebo-controlled study. So in this case, we're providing methylphenidate as our placebo control.
Oh, so like you were saying before, Patrick, this may help with this idea. So they're going to experience probably some elevated heart rate, maybe some anxiety, maybe some, you know, feelings that may make them think, oh, I may have gotten the psilocybin.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's one of the ideas. It's been used as a control in prior psilocybin studies, including at Hopkins. As I recall, it has from the earliest study it was used, I believe the number is somewhere around 35% of participants who were randomized to that arm thought that they had gotten psilocybin. So it's better than nothing. Not an optimal, you know, that's not a rate that would be like the optimal kind of blinding rate. But still, you know, if that holds up, that's, you know, better than just a sugar pill where they're not going to feel anything. A number of other studies now have used niacin, which again provides a kind of a sort of physiological effect, but I would argue not as strong as what you might expect with something like methylphenidate.
Okay. So how many doses do the participants get?
They're just getting there's one dosing session in this study.
Okay. So, and then they have a pre-session with a guide, the dosing session itself, and then the consolidation session?
Exactly. So, yeah. So the structure is three phases. As Rebecca mentioned, we have preparation, dosing, integration. In the preparation phase, they meet with a number of people involved in the study, but explicitly spend a good amount of time with the lead guide, who is a credentialed mental health professional, and that is a standard in our work, but also now is required by the FDA that the lead facilitator should have a mental health credential. And so they meet with that person. And then also we have what we call an assistant guide or an assistant facilitator, who is kind of another person to provide support, and is going to be there in the dosing session. And so they'll meet with those individuals. They will spend a good amount of time. In our study, it's going to be at least 4 hours of time in the preparation phase, and it can be more if the participant sort of reaches out and wants kind of additional time. And in other studies, you'll see in some of the studies that have been published, say 5, 6, 7 years ago, that preparation time has been even longer. I think it's been, you know, we've been trying to figure out what's the right amount to provide certainly the amount of support necessary to maintain safety. And then at what point, can we reduce the burden on participants so that, you know, they're not having to come in for 8, 10, 12 hours before they do their dosing session. So, we think about this preparation phase as both as really primarily in the interest of safety and comfort, leading a patient to this dosing session so that they really feel as comfortable as possible going into it, that they understand what's going to happen, that they have people there who are on their side and that are going to support them if things get challenging and scary, that they understand the normative kind of process that goes on with this. And then it also has potentially a therapeutic component too, right? So they're talking with somebody, they're telling them, in the case of, say, depression, about their life history with depression, how that's impacted their life, what they're hoping to get out of this experience. And that alone can be very therapeutic. I think, getting back to what I mentioned before, measuring that has been difficult and is continuing to be a focus of the field. We want to measure, to the extent that we can, what are we getting from a therapeutic aspect out of just that simple, supportive, non-directive psychotherapeutic approach versus, you know, other considerations. And there are other trials out there right now and more in the works where people are trying to actively sort of merge an explicit psychotherapeutic modality with this kind of supportive preparation framework.
Yeah, I mean, so interesting. And you'll see, right? Because if you had the exact same effect in both groups and it was a positive effect, you'd know that the therapy part was just, you know, good enough by itself. Yeah. Presumably, you will see an increased effect with the therapy plus the psilocybin, but that'll be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do we have any idea, like, on a level of the patient, like, what happens? So if you have, you know, severe depression, let's say refractory depression, that you've had tried, you know, everything else, it hasn't worked, and then you take psilocybin or something similar and you have an effect, is it that during the time, and I may be asking a question no one knows the answer to, but is it that during the time you are under the influence of this drug, you experience joy that you haven't experienced, you know, while you've had this depression, and that somehow you can continue to access those feelings afterwards? Is it do we think it's more of a rewiring that, you know, kind of something was wrong structurally with whatever axonal circuits have developed, and that now we've reconfigured them somehow and that therefore we're better, or do we not know? Or is it something that I haven't even thought of?
They're good questions. Rebecca, do you want to take a stab? And then I have some thoughts too.
No, definitely, Patrick. Interested to hear your thoughts as well. So I do think part of it is that kind of during the psychedelic experience itself, and especially given the fact that people are being there with facilitators and guides, Some people do seem to have sort of emotional breakthroughs. People have this perceived sense of new insight or letting go, things like that. So it's not necessarily only, you know, some of the subjective joy or other emotions that people have, but it's also a different sense of insight that people experience during their dosing session itself. And then that alongside with the support that they're getting to kind of integrate those insights into their life, into their overall perspective. I think some of those things are part of the drivers of what causes these effects, but I do think it's a great question. And I do think there's certainly an extent to which the jury is still out on that and more work needs to be done.
Yeah. Yeah, that's totally on point. I think, you know, what I would say to this kind of series of questions, which I think is really good, and I think it really cuts to like what's really going on, and how are these clinical effects being instantiated. I think besides just saying, well, the jury's out and we'll figure it out, there are likely multiple courses, and I think two are really intriguing to me. One is through the lens of increased personal meaning. Many people come out of these experiences reporting that it was the most meaningful or among the most meaningful experience of their lives. And they take that feeling of having tapped into something deeply meaningful to them, even if they can't all the time articulate exactly what that was, they have a touch point with this sense of meaningfulness and value. And people report that coming out of that. And then I think there is a potential, and again, we need to measure this well, but I think there's a potential for that sort of augmented sense of personal meaning to then translate into these clinical benefits. And so if we take, for example, the case of the depression data that we've seen, but I think this maps on really nicely to the experiences of people with chronic pain. It's this idea that people come into these trials with very little hope and often a lack of agency and a lack of meaning in life. And in many cases, they've lost touch with the valued activities that kind of naturally should provide reward and reinforcement. And they're not engaging in those activities at anywhere near the frequency that they were maybe at an earlier point in their life, when they had developed a sense of identity and an agency within that identity that they can say, this is me, this is how I operate, this is what I value. When that's gone, which happens in the course of major depression, and it happens in the course of many patients' lives with chronic pain, the available therapies we have do a pretty poor job of helping people gain touch with that. And so I think that is a potential avenue and potentially intriguing one for us to figure out how can we measure this the best. But the other thing that I would say, and this is really from my experience working on the depression trial, is although people will report that this was an intensely meaningful experience, many patients also reported that they were simply just not experiencing the negative symptoms anymore. So they might have had a really positive experience, or part of their psilocybin experience might have been really positive. It might have been mixed with challenging experiences. But they may come out and saying, yeah, you know, I had this period of bliss or intense love, but they're not like feeling that for days and weeks and months after the session, right? That tends to go away with the drug effects. And then what they're left with often is just saying, you know, I can't really put my finger on it, but I don't feel as agitated as I did before. I don't feel as guilty about everything as I did before. And it's those types of kind of enmeshed negative cognitive views and emotions that become enmeshed with the sense of identity we are seeing tend to be stripped away after these sessions.
Very, very interesting. So now I want to ask about the back pain part of this. So, you know, do we think that the psilocybin it somehow actually improves the pain, or that when you improve the depression, the pain is either more tolerable or gets better, you know, by virtue of that? Or do we, is that part of what you're trying to figure out?
Well, I think that's part of what we're trying to figure out. You know, we're looking at not just pain intensity and chronic pain severity, although that is a key measure, an outcome of interest. But our hypotheses are really centered around the affective components of pain, measures the degree to which their positive emotions increase and negative emotions decrease. We're looking at that in the course of their daily lives. And so we're going to be able to essentially model the extent to which changes in pain fluctuate with changes in emotions in that way through a repeated sampling process. We're modeling that experimentally. So we're inducing positive and negative affective states in the lab and pairing that with experimental pain stimuli, not during the dosing session. This is a sort of pre-post measure, but we're looking at the extent to which positive emotions inhibit pain in this experimental task and how psilocybin may or may not modulate that association. We're also looking at a construct called pain catastrophizing, which is really well studied in the pain field. It's a maladaptive thought process that many patients with pain experience, really many people in general experience when you encounter pain in your life. And that's the tendency to magnify or ruminate about pain or feel helpless about pain. And so this is another process that we think this treatment may have a potential to reduce the extent to which people experience catastrophizing thoughts about their pain.
Very interesting. Okay. Are there studies that have been done that you're aware of that looked at psilocybin in patients with chronic pain and without depression to look at whether it improved the pain, or has that not been done?
Are there studies, are you asking, are there studies that we can base this on in which psilocybin has been administered just in a chronic pain sample that does not have depression on board?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's any data suggesting it helps with pain in the absence of depression.
The available data on pain are really slim. So I think getting back to what I was saying earlier, there are some studies from the 60s which suggest that psychedelics, serotonergic psychedelics, can have an acute analgesic effect, like in the dosing session, for patients with chronic pain. But those studies, to my knowledge, we don't know a whole lot about what the comorbidities were in those samples, and how many of those patients also had depression or not. Ongoing trials, I think, yes, there are ongoing trials of patients with chronic pain who do not necessarily have major depression on board. I don't know all of the inclusion-exclusion criteria for those trials, but I would be willing to bet that they're probably not excluding for depression because of how common it is. And I mean, they could be. There would be a scientific argument for trying to do that. It would just be very difficult to enroll your sample.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's no NMDA receptor action of psilocybin. Is that right? It's just through serotonin?
Well, that's getting outside of, my clinical psychology background. I'm not aware of an NMDA action of psilocybin, but I can't definitively say that there's not a basic study out there showing some activity there.
Okay, but primarily serotonin. I only ask because we know that ketamine can, when given intraoperatively and postoperatively, can help reduce the development of chronic pain. And so I wondered if that was related, but maybe these are two different mechanisms. It'll be very interesting to see the results of the trial. When do we expect the results to come out? Is it soon, or are we looking at a couple years down the road?
No, we're looking at a couple years. We just started enrolling
okay.
a few months ago. So we're a couple years out before we'll have results to report, but we can certainly keep you updated when we get them.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back on when you have the results. That'd be great to hear about it. So what do we think the future holds, other than the results of your study? What is the future of this area? It's such a obviously interesting and promising field. What do we think the future holds?
Rebecca, why don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so I think as we've touched upon previously, we do need larger clinical trials with more diverse samples. A recent review just came out and it said what we already sort of know, which is that the patient populations that have participated thus far in these trials have been primarily white, and we're really invested in diversifying, including in our current chronic low back pain and depression study. So I do think that's really important for the field, just to ensure that results can be properly generalizable, that everyone is included in these trials. But then another thing that I wanted to mention was basically the definition of and standardizing of adverse events. So I do think everyone recognizes the absolute importance of capturing and transparently reporting adverse events. There's definitely a huge focus on that. But adverse events in psychedelics are perhaps a little bit more difficult to capture in certain ways than adverse events of other medications, just because of the different levels of acute subjective effects and what really should be counting as something that's adverse as opposed to merely an effect. So this is something that the field is still working on, how to standardize and define these measures, what should be captured as, say, an adverse event of special interest because it's particularly pertinent to psychedelics. And so this is something that we're all kind of actively working on, but I wanted to point that out as something that the field, I think, is moving more towards standardization and better definitions for these things while continuing to transparently report anything that may occur.
Yeah, that's really obviously super important. Patrick, anything to add?
Yeah, I would say for me, one of the things that I am most interested in seeing evolve over the coming years is an understanding of what therapeutic processes, if any, are needed to optimize the effects of psilocybin and let's say other psychedelics and the general psychedelic assisted therapy model. The base package, I would say, that we have now is generally non-directive, and yet we have a number of sort of well-characterized psychotherapeutic modalities that one could argue mechanistically overlap really well, actually several, like mindfulness meditation, acceptance and commitment therapy, even cognitive behavioral therapy. You can point to a number of mechanisms that would ostensibly overlap with those that were that are presumed to underlie the effects of psychedelics, like, for example, psychological flexibility. And so it's a very open question whether layering those types of treatments into the delivery, into the sort of phased preparation, dosing, and integration is something that could increase the magnitude of effects. But I think more importantly, because we're seeing magnitude effects are really large, I think what we're really interested in is the durability of effects, right? Can layering a therapeutic modality into that process extend these effects for longer, give people tools to kind of take what they've gained in the dosing session and carry it with them in their lives? So I'm really excited about that. I know a lot of people are really interested in figuring that out.
Yeah, really exciting stuff. All right, well, this has been fabulous. Is there anything either of you thinks that we didn't mention that we should before we move on?
No, I think we've covered a good bit about what we're trying to do and general landscape of the field. I feel like it's good, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, I have no idea if this is true, but if you're currently enrolling and someone's listening to this and they think, I want to enroll, is that something you're interested in? If so, how would they do that? We can put a link maybe in the show notes to something, to a website they could go to, or how does that work?
Yeah, we would definitely be interested in that. We are very much actively recruiting and seeking new participants. So I can provide a link to the study website. I can provide the study email, or obviously reaching out to either me, Patrick, or David Yaden directly.
Perfect. All right. Well, we'll definitely include a link in the show notes. So if anyone is interested in participating, you can hop on, or if you have a friend who or a family member who might be interested.
Fabulous. Well, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. I'm going to ask each of you to recommend something the audience can check out for fun. Rebecca, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So I'd like to recommend the book A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson. My understanding is they made a movie of it and the movie's not good. So I don't recommend that, which I also haven't seen. But the book's hilarious. He basically goes for a long hike on the Appalachian Trail. And so it's interspersed with his personal stories, which is told so hilariously, as well as the actual history of the Appalachian Trail itself, which is just really interesting. So it's a book I've gone back to many times over the years. It's phenomenal on every reread.
Fabulous. Thank you. Patrick, how about you?
Well, I'll just give you whatever I've been listening to lately, which in this past week, I've been reacquainted with Robert Earl Keen, who I hadn't listened to in a number of years and was reminded how awesome he is as a trailblazing songwriter. And so I'll recommend his 1993 album, Gringo Honeymoon. Fantastic album. And then something more recent, King Gizzard and the Wizard Lizard is an awesome, awesome rock and roll band that has been putting stuff out for a while and just came out with a brand new album that is fire. So check them out.
Awesome. Love it. We don't often get music recommendations, but I love having some variety. So that's great. I'm going to mix it up too and recommend a card game. We just got back from vacation and this is a card game the whole family plays, and it's a 4-person card game, but we play in different groups. It's a ton of fun. It is called Tichu, T-I-C-H-U. And it is unlike any card game I kind of grew up knowing. And I learned about this from my brother. I don't know where he got it from, but it's a separate deck. It's actually very much like a traditional card deck, except it has 4 extra cards. And it is sort of like a spades or hearts type game, but with some added rules. And it's very fun. It's easy to play. The kids, my kids started playing when they were probably around 8 or 9. So it's not for little kids, but certainly learnable by kids once they get to be about that age. And it's pretty easy. You can play a hand in maybe 5 minutes. And then depending on what score you play up to, it can be a game that goes for anywhere from, 15, 20 minutes up to an hour. But it's a lot of fun. And if you're looking for a fun new card game, check out Tichu. All right. Rebecca, Patrick, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Awesome.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter. And we're at Acrack Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrack. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrack. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of 3 and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.